happy birthday today to George Benson of Ankeny. Happy birthday, George. You are joined, and this may set you back some, folks. It sure did me. You were joined today, George, on your birth date by Julian Lennon. That's John Lennon's son, and he turned 61. Who would have thought that John Lennon's son could be 61 years old? That's a little scary. I have an announcement to read for you, and you went, this sounds like a lot of fun. The Iris has a limited number of free tickets to the Sunday, April 14, 2 p.m. performance of Beautiful, the Carole King musical, with live audio description by the Des Moines Community Playhouse. Beautiful tells the story, the performance is put on by the Des Moines Community Playhouse, but of course that's Iris that does the live audio description. Beautiful tells the story of the early life and career of Carole King, weaving a tapestry with songs that she wrote throughout. If you are interested in attending this performance, please call the Iris office at 515-243-6833. You are listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. If you're hearing us on your television or Iowa PBS and you are not a registered IRIS user, please give us a call at 515-243-6833 so we can get you on our list. We need to know who is listening in order to keep our services free. And now with today's obituary, here's Nicole.
We would like to remember Judy Gilman today. Judy Jane Gilman, 86 years old, of Des Moines, passed away at Valley View Village, surrounded by those who loved her. Funeral services will be at the Ellis Grandview Park Chapel on Thursday, April 11th, starting at 11 a.m. A visitation will be on Wednesday, April 10th, from 5 to 7 p.m. Interment will be at the Berwick Cemetery. Judy Jane Carr was born to James and Alice Carr on March 18, 1938, in Des Moines. She met and later married her high school sweetheart from Woodside High School, Gilbert Leroy Gilman, on July 3, 1953. Together, they raised their family in Des Moines. Judy loved being outdoors and camping, especially at Twin Anchors in Colo. Judy was active in her church, especially as a choir singer. Most of all, she loved spending time with her family. She's survived by her husband of 70 and a half years, Gilbert Gilman, children Ed and Galen, brother Tom, grandchildren Kelsey, Michael, Jamie, Aubrey, Josh, Kristen, Dana, Emily, Rachel, Delina, and Shauna. She also has great-grandchildren Dallas, Adrian, Margot, Jalen, Jaden, and Landon. Oh, there's more, I'm sorry. Ariana, Chevy, Abigail, Katie, Sadler, and Canton. She also has 3 great-great-grandchildren, my goodness, and also many nieces and nephews. She is preceded in death by her parents and sisters, Anne and Nancy. Memorial contributions may be directed to the Berwick Congregational Church or St. Jude's Children's Hospital. You can also leave online condolences at illiscares.com.
And now returning to the national stories that are in the front page section of the Register. This one from Albuquerque, New Mexico. This is from the Reuters News Service. Civilians respond to mental health calls. Unarmed emergency responders Nevada Sanchez and Sean Martin take a police dispatch call in southeast Albuquerque, New Mexico, a city with high rates of violent crime and police shootings. They have no enforcement powers or protective equipment and say they use their voices and brains to de-escalate encounters with people in mental health and substance abuse crises. On some occasions, they may have saved lives. As they drive through a sprawl of squat beige buildings and strip malls, Martin and Sanchez recall occasional times they talked down people holding a weapon. Martin said he persuaded one man to throw a knife into a neighbor's yard, telling him officers were on their way. When they arrived, Martin told them the man was no longer armed and things ended peacefully. "On that day, I can't help but think we prevented him from being harmed," said Martin, 53. Albuquerque, with the second highest rate of police killings among cities over 250,000 people, according to Mapping Police Violence, that's the name of a website, has set up one of the country's most ambitious civilian responder programs to offer help rather than law enforcement to people in crisis. Such initiatives have spread across the United States since the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis highlighted police killings of people of color and those suffering from mental illness or substance abuse, said Alex Vitale, professor of sociology at Brooklyn College. The 2.5-year-old Albuquerque Community Safety Department now takes the majority of mental health and behavioral health calls when there is not a weapon or danger to responders. ACS measures success on metrics such as how many people it transports for mental health services and lowering police shootings, Director Maria Ruiz Angel said. Albuquerque's officer-involved shootings hit a record in 2022, with 11 people killed, nearly as many as the 13 in New York City, with about 15 times the population. Fatal police shootings eased to 7 in 2023, still high. Around a third of incidents involved someone in a mental health crisis. No ACS mobile crisis teams was involved in police shooting. In the same period, the number of people ACS offered housing more than doubled in 1,454, while provision of mental or behavioral health services nearly tripled to 904, according to city data. Albuquerque is a really good example of what it looks like to go beyond implementing a program to building out an institution and an infrastructure that can anchor changing our public safety and emergency response system, said Daniela Gilbert, a director of the Vera Institute, which researches criminal justice. ACS, a city department independent of police and fire, offers services ranging from school violence intervention programs to outreach for people without a home. Many police departments support civilians taking a non-criminal emergency calls so officers can respond to felonies faster. Albuquerque Police Commander Jeff Barnard would like to see ACS get additional funding and resources to continue work. The Department of Justice has monitored Albuquerque police since 2014 after it found a pattern of excessive use of force. It recommended ACS take on more 911 calls. Sean Willoughby, head of the APD Officers Union, said ACS was an attribute, but it was what he called fantasy to think responders could replace officers due to limits on the types of calls they can take without police support. The real problem that faces Albuquerque is that we don't have enough police officers and crime is out of control, he said, citing what he called an exploding fentanyl problem. Unlike programs in New York, Chicago, and Houston, ACS behavioral health teams are dispatched without paramedics or police who can trigger people. It is absolutely our preference that whenever possible, these civilian responders are responding without police, said Daniel Williams of the American Civil Liberties Union of New Mexico, citing the safety of people in crisis. ACS responders are trained to retreat if threatened. Their most serious injury to date is a responder shot at random by a child with an air gun. When an unsheltered woman charged Sanchez with a shovel, she said she ran. If someone tells us to go away, we go away, said the 28-year-old who has a master's degree in forensic psychology and uses breathing exercises to calm people in distress. Word of spreading ACS's ability to get mental illness patients to hospitals who would not go with officers or paramedics after they may have seen a handcuff or may have been handcuffed in the past. I don't think I read that right. And that may have been confusing to you. Let me reread that rather long sentence. Word is spreading of ACS's ability to get mental health and mental illness patients to hospitals who would not go with officers or paramedics after they may have been handcuffed in the past. People are now saying, don't send officers, said Martin, a licensed clinical social worker. Since ACS launched its increased monthly call volume fourfold, around 3,200, over two-thirds of calls diverted from police, taking about 5% of all 911 calls. Eugene, Oregon's CAHOOTS, among the oldest responder programs in the country. That CAHOOTS is all in caps. I suspect that's an acronym, but it doesn't say of what. At any rate, the program is called CAHOOTS, and it's among the oldest responder programs in the country. It handles about 8% of 911 calls, according to its coordinator, Adam Walsh. ACS faces challenges. Ruiz Angel laments a lack of hospital beds, shelter spaces, or addiction centers for the people responders are called to. How big ACS can grow is limited by annual funding of around $17 million. The police get $268 million. ACS has 65 responders. Albuquerque Police has around 900 officers.
And the final story in this section, East Coast quake, rare but not totally unheard of. A 4.8 magnitude earthquake hit New Jersey and affected nearby states on Friday morning, leaving people on the East Coast rattled and the ground trembling. The quake was reported around 10:23 a.m. about 5 miles north of the White House Station in New Jersey, according to the U.S. Geological Survey. The quake's epicenter was around 45 miles from New York City, causing New Yorkers to feel furniture and floor shake. People from Norfolk, Virginia to Maine reported feeling the quake. Areas in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, and Massachusetts all experienced the ground ripple. An earthquake on the East Coast does not happen often, unlike the West Coast, where California annually gets 2 or 3 earthquakes large enough to cause moderate damage to structures. This is according to the California Department of Conservation. Earthquakes are less frequent in the eastern part of the U.S. when compared to the West Coast, but they have occurred in every state east of the Mississippi River, according to USGS. Some quakes were large enough to cause damage in nearly all eastern states, said the government agency that studies the country's landscape, natural resources, and natural hazards. Let's see. Since colonial times, people in the New York, Philadelphia, Wilmington urban corridor have felt small quakes and suffered damage from infrequent larger ones, according to the USGS. Moderately damaging earthquakes strike somewhere between in urban corridors roughly twice a century, and smaller earthquakes are felt roughly every 2 to 3 years. While not a common occurrence, earthquakes on the East Coast usually cause higher frequency shaking, fast back and forth motion, compared to similar events in the West, the USGS said. Faster shaking normally makes shorter structures more susceptible to the damage, while slower shaking typically affects taller structures, according to the agency. Many of the older structures in the East, such as buildings and bridges that's built before the 1970s, were not designed to endure earthquakes and therefore may not fare well. The East Coast is progressing in retrofitting older buildings and constructing modern buildings that abide by newer design standards, according to the USGS. On the West Coast, older structures are more frequently retrofitted, and new structures are regularly designed to withstand strong shaking, the agency said. The western U.S. experiences more earthquakes because it lies along the boundaries of major tectonic plates that make up the Earth's crust. The North American plate and the ocean plates to the west, USGS said. These plates are moving against each other, breaking up the crust along many faults like the San Andreas Fault, according to the agency. Faults in the east are less active and lie entirely within the North American plate. Scientists do have a harder time assessing earthquakes' frequency and magnitudes on the East Coast because of the geology of the eastern U.S. and the relatively sparse history of earthquakes to study, according to the USGS. The agency also says eastern earthquakes are more of a mystery because they do not take place at a plate boundary where most other earthquakes originate. Scientists do not fully understand the state of stress within tectonic plates, and they're studying how stresses accumulate and evolve and how those earthquakes are triggered. Another challenge scientists encounter is locating the active faults on the East Coast.
And that concludes the stories in the front page section of the Register. We'll move now to the Nation and World section of USA Today. The first story, data privacy deal is drafted. Two key U.S. lawmakers said on Sunday they struck a deal to draft bipartisan data privacy legislation that would restrict consumer data with technology companies and what they can collect and give Americans the power to prevent selling of personal information or compel its deletion. The agreement between Democratic Senator Maria Cantwell, who chairs the Commerce Committee, and Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, Republican chair of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, would give individuals control over use of their personal information and require disclosure if data had been transferred to foreign adversaries. Congress has been debating online privacy protection since at least 2019 amid concerns about use of data by social media companies, including Meta Platforms Facebook, Alphabet's Google, and ByteDance-owned TikTok, but have been unable to reach agreement. Aides told reporters on Sunday they hope to advance legislation soon. Meta, TikTok, and Google could not immediately be reached for comment. In a joint statement, the lawmakers said the plan gives the Federal Trade Commission and state attorneys general broad authority to oversee consumer privacy issues and establish what it called robust enforcement mechanisms to hold violators accountable, including a private right of action for individuals. The bill does not ban targeted advertising, but gives consumers the ability to opt out of it. The FTC would create a new bureau focused on privacy and could issue fines for privacy violations, which would also cover telecommunications companies. In 2019, Facebook agreed to pay a record-breaking $5 billion fine to resolve an FTC probe into its privacy practices, triggered by allegations that Facebook violated a 2012 consent decree. The FTC now wants to tighten that existing privacy settlement to ban profiting from minors' data and expand curbs on facial recognition technology. In 2021, ByteDance agreed to a $92 million class action settlement regarding data privacy claims from some U.S. TikTok users. Reuters reported last month that the FTC could soon resolve its investigation into TikTok over allegedly faulty privacy and data security practices. Google and its YouTube unit in 2019 paid $170 million in a settlement with the FTC and New York to resolve allegations it broke federal law by collecting personal information about children. U.S. lawmakers Cantwell and Rogers added, "This bipartisan bicameral draft legislation is the best opportunity we've had in decades to establish national data privacy and security standards that give people the right to control their personal information." That's the end of the quote from Cantwell and Rogers. The measure would allow people to opt out of data processing if a company changes its privacy policy. It requires what it calls affirmative express consent before sensitive data can be transferred to a third party. Consumers could sue what are called bad actors who violate their privacy rights and recover money for damages when they've been harmed. And it would stop companies from using people's personal information to discriminate against them, the statement said. The bill would require annual reviews of algorithms to ensure they do not put individuals, including our youth, at risk of harm, including discrimination. That's the end of the quote from the bill.
Now I'm going to read some in-brief stories. There's four of them. The first is a man arrested for setting fire to Senator Bernie Sanders' office door. A man was arrested on Sunday on a charge of starting a fire outside of the office of Senator Bernie Sanders in Burlington, Vermont. This is according to the U.S. Attorney's Office for the state. Shan Shakomonian, 35 years old, entered the building in downtown Burlington on Friday and then headed to Sanders' office on the third floor. He was recorded by security cameras spraying a liquid near the door and then setting it alight, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Sprinklers then went off on multiple floors as that suspect departed via a staircase. There were several people inside that office, but no one was injured, although the door and surrounding areas were damaged by the fire. It was not immediately clear whether that suspect had a lawyer, and he couldn't be reached for comment. Sanders is a long-serving independent in the U.S. Senate representing the northeastern state of Vermont, although in 2016 and 2020, he unsuccessfully sought to become the Democratic Party's presidential nominee. Powerball player wins $1.3 billion in jackpot. A ticket that sold on the West Coast in Oregon has won the Powerball jackpot of more than $1.3 billion. It's the eighth largest in the U.S. history. Powerball drew the numbers early on Sunday, and the winning numbers were white balls 22, 27, 44, 52, 69, and the red Powerball number 9. The drawing is the 41st since the last Powerball winner hit that jackpot on New Year's Day. The winner matched the correct 6 double digits on a $2 ticket. Oh my gosh, $2 is $1.3 billion? All right, well, the chances of that happening are 1 in 292.2 million, which means the top prize rolls over multiple times and the jackpot just gets bigger. The lottery drawing, initially set for 11 p.m. Eastern Time on Saturday, was delayed to complete the required procedures before announcing the numbers. The prize of around $1.3 billion can be taken as a single lump sum of about $608.9 million. The other option is an initial payment followed by 29 annual payments. Powerball tickets are sold in 45 states and Washington, D.C., the U.S. Virgin Islands, and in Puerto Rico. But the big question is, did that person come forward and claim that money yet? We're not sure. Anyway, I will do one more if you want to take the last one, Twyla. And the last one takes us overseas to Beijing, where China's electric vehicle companies do not rely on subsidies to gain a competitive advantage. Commerce Minister Wang Wentao says in a roundtable discussion in Paris on Sunday. Wang also says the accusations by the United States and Europe of China's, quote, overcapacity are groundless. This is according to a statement from the Commerce Ministry on Monday. Wang made those remarks at a roundtable meeting of Chinese firms, where he is set to for those talks that are expected to cover China's exports of electric vehicles into the European market. Representatives of more than 10 enterprises such as Geely, BYD, and CATL all attended that meeting.
Cancer vaccine shrinks tumors. A small trial shows promise to treat the liver. And this is another story from Reuters. Nearly a third of patients with advanced liver cancer who received a personalized vaccine developed with Jynneos Therapeutics along with an immunotherapy drug in a small early trial saw their tumors shrink, researchers reported on Sunday. The result was roughly twice the response typically seen with the immunotherapy alone, the researchers said. Findings from the preliminary study presented at the American Association for Cancer Research in San Diego and published in Nature Medicine suggest that vaccines based on mutations only present in a patient's tumor may boost the immune system's ability to recognize and attack hard-to-treat cancers. The findings, which must be confirmed in the larger trial, moves the industry another step closer to effective cancer vaccines after many past failures and may expand the types of cancers such therapies can treat. Partners Moderna and American Company and others have had promising results combining customized vaccines with immunotherapy to prevent skin cancer from returning in patients following surgery. For the study, researchers used samples from patients' tumors to build vaccines based on neoantigens, new mutations only present on an individual patient's tumor. The goal was to train the immune system to attack and kill only these unique proteins, leaving healthy tissue unscathed. Unlike skin cancer, which has many mutations for the body to recognize, liver cancer is considered a cold cancer because it contains fewer mutations, which has rendered immunotherapies less effective. This vaccine essentially educates the immune system to recognize antigens that it has ignored, said study leader Dr. Mark Yocohen of Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center. The study involved 36 patients with hepatocellular carcinoma, the most common form of liver cancer. Patients were given custom-made vaccines on top of Merck's widely used immunotherapy Keytruda, the standard care at the time. Excuse me. Nearly a third of the patients treated with the combination therapy, 30.1%, experienced tumor shrinkage, with three of those subjects having a complete response meaning no detectable signs of tumor remaining after the median follow-up of 21.5 months.
All right. We're going to head back to 50 states now before we wrap up, and we're going to continue on with those Midwest states. Out of West Lafayette, Indiana, SK Hynix Incorporation, the world's leading producer of the high-bandwidth memory chips, will invest an estimated $3.87 billion in West Lafayette to build an advanced packaging fabrication and research and development facility for artificial intelligence products. Topeka, Kansas, public records show that the Kansas Attorney General, Chris Korbach, awarded a no-bid contract to a law firm that's helping the state sue social media company TikTok. Korbach's office justified not seeking competitive bids when hiring law firm Cooper & Kirk because of a, quote, emergency. Let's see, out of Detroit, Michigan, the Michigan Department of Natural Resources is investigating a mystery. How did a gray wolf wind up in Calhoun County, hundreds of miles from the Upper Peninsula and the state's only known population of endangered species? What is known is that a hunter shot what he thought was a large coyote this past winter during a legal hunt with a guide. The wolf was found in the southwest corner of Michigan, where the species hasn't been seen since the early part of the 20th century when they disappeared. Victims of a long-standing state bounty, unscrupulous hunters, and also a changing habitat. In St. Paul, Minnesota, the state Supreme Court is hearing an expedited challenge to the law that restored voting rights to more than 55,000 Minnesotans with felony convictions. Columbia, Missouri, almost all 2023 University of Missouri graduates got a job, continued their educations, joined the military, or are volunteering, according to an MU Career Outcome Survey. 6 months after graduation, 95% of those graduates had placements. And Omaha, Nebraska, police said that three men had been arrested in connection with the shooting death of a 30-year-old man. And to, let's see here, Bismarck, North Dakota, Governor Doug Burgum announced that the adjutant general of the North Dakota National Guard will be retiring at the end of September. Columbus, Ohio, despite signs warning drivers to turn back, red reflectors and sometimes flashing lights, wrong-way crashes have increased throughout Ohio in recent years. Preliminary data for 2023 shows 182 wrong-way crashes happened on divided highways in that state last year. And in Oklahoma City, in Oklahoma, some residents of a West Oklahoma City neighborhood are now protesting a new amphitheater that's set to be built near their homes and schools. Critics of this venue see the new addition as a bad neighbor to schools and neighbors to the area. They've cited worries about loud noise and busy traffic on days when there is a concert or event. But specifically, some people are concerned that sound checks will start before school lets out and that concerts will run late into the evening. I'm going to do Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and then we'll wrap up with Wisconsin. So in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, inmates at one of the state's prison facilities say tensions are rising as those residents prepare to lose a lifeline to their outside support systems. The Department of Corrections intend to limit the number of phone calls that state inmates in South Dakota can make each day. This is according to the Director of Corrections. And finally, a wrap-up on news in the Midwest out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Freshman applicants to the University of Wisconsin System Schools can forego standardized tests for two more years under a policy extension that's approved by the UW Board of Regents on Friday. A long-standing policy did require incoming freshmen to submit ACT or SAT scores, but that board now suspended the requirement in 2020 when the pandemic severely restricted the number of testing sites available. The board has extended the temporary policy a few times.
And we'll wrap up this shift with this short story out of Singapore. Oil tumbles nearly 2% as Middle East tensions ease. Oil prices fell more than $1 a barrel on Monday, with Brent sliding under $90 as Middle East tensions eased after Israel withdrew more soldiers from southern Gaza and committed to fresh talks on a potential ceasefire in the six-month conflict. Brent crude futures slipped $1.70, or 1.9%. 5% to $89.47 a barrel. U.S. West Texas Intermediate crude was at $85.29 a barrel, down $1.62 or 1.9%. The world's top oil exporter, Saudi Arabia, raised official selling prices for all crude grades in Asia in May, in line with expectations after heavy oil supplies tightened. Fire struck an offshore platform operated by Mexico's national oil company, Pemex, on Saturday, killing at least one contractor. This comes after Pemex requested its trading unit to cancel up to 436,000 barrels per day of crude exports in April. However, Goldman Sachs analysts expect Brent to stay below $100 a barrel in its base case scenario that assumes already solid demand, no further geopolitical hits to the oil supply, and that elevated spare capacity will lead OPEC Plus to raise production in the third quarter. In the United States, oil rigs rose by 2 to 508 last week, while gas rigs fell by 2 to 110, the lowest since January 2022, Baker Hughes said in its report on Friday. And that comes to the end of this shift. For the past 90 minutes, your readers have been Nicole Tam and me, Twyla Glenn. It's been our pleasure to read for you. Now we'll take a short break to let our next readers get into place.
Welcome back. Your new readers are Carol Lockhart and Jeff Cassett. We'll continue now with articles from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Here's Carol with our next article.
Thank you, Jeff. And from USA Today, the opinion page, breathtaking, barely describes solar eclipse, article by Ingrid Jacks. It's hard to believe it was already 7 years ago because the total solar eclipse on August 21st, 2017 still feels like a fresh memory. With the next total eclipse happening Monday in many parts of the country, I've been thinking a lot about what I witnessed. The path of totality crossed over Salem, Oregon, where I grew up and where my parents still live, so I made sure to plan a visit during that time. I figured it would be something special to see, and it was, putting it mildly. Having grown up in the Pacific Northwest with natural beauty all around, I have always loved nature and enjoying the great outdoors. When camping as a kid, some of my favorite memories are getting up in the night and being dazzled by a tapestry of stars overhead. Yet the idea of space and the seemingly infinite number of planets and stars is unsettling. It makes one feel so insignificant and small. When events like an eclipse happen, they bring to the forefront how we're just one planet hurtling through this never-ending void. So, I was expecting to feel something along those lines. I did, but I hadn't anticipated just how breathtaking it would be. What's it like to watch a solar eclipse? On a hot and thankfully clear summer morning, we watched the whole thing from my parents' backyard. The colors around us changed as the moon covered more of the sun. It was like observing a sunset in fast motion. That moment, though, when totality occurred, when the moon fully covers the sun, was simply beautiful, with the light of the sun's corona dancing in the sky. I don't think I took my eyes from it the entire 2.5 minutes. My parents and husband saw it with me, and I recently asked them what the experience was like from their perspective. My hard-to-impress husband said it was a whole lot cooler than I thought it was going to be. He remembers the stars coming out, and then the birds beginning to sing as if it were dawn. It was awesome, he said. My dad recalls it as wondrous and delightful, especially because he got to see it from his own yard and did not have to contend with the flocks of people who had descended on our state. My mom had more mixed feelings. She said it felt like we were being plunged into never-ending darkness. Once the sun began to emerge again, she felt better. We all described the eclipse as unforgettable. A once-in-a-lifetime event for many. Part of what makes a total solar eclipse so special is that it's rare. When such events happen over large swaths of the country, as was the case in 2017, and will be on Monday, it's a bonding experience for millions of Americans. The excitement and buildup ahead of this year's eclipse and the fact so many of us will watch it at the same time is reminiscent of a celestial Super Bowl. In 2017, NASA estimates more than 200 million U.S. adults viewed the eclipse either in person or electronically. Monday's eclipse has the potential to reach an even wider swath of the country because of where it will arc, starting in Texas and ending in Maine. And totality will last longer this time, up to more than 4 minutes. According to Scientific American from 1924 to 2023, only 13 total solar eclipses crossed the contiguous United States or Alaska. In the next 100 years, just 11 will be visible. After Monday, the next total eclipse that will cross a wide swath of the United States does not occur until the year 2045. My nieces and nephews will be in smack middle of the path of totality. This year, I will unfortunately not be in the path of totality. But my brother and his family in Texas will be. I am crossing my fingers Mother Nature cooperates for them to see it clearly. I called my nieces and nephews last week to see what they think about getting to watch the eclipse. Monday will be their first total solar eclipse, although last fall they saw the annular eclipse, which is when the moon passes between the sun and the earth, but when it is at or near its farthest point from the earth. And here's what the kids had to say. Avila, age 14, said, "I'll be very excited to be able to see a full eclipse instead of a partial one. This will be particularly interesting to be able to see the effects in the sky and in the shadows, especially with so many trees around." Avila, who is very artistic, recalls the light from the annular eclipse in October as very startling. "All of the trees down the street and in our yard started to cast the most unusual and weird shadows." Lily, age 12, said, "I haven't seen a full eclipse, and it sounds really exciting." Campion, age 10, said, "Our house is so perfect. We're in the smack middle of it, so it's going to be pitch black. Except the cool thing is that on the horizon it will be like a giant ring." Benedict, age 8, said, "It turns out the whole sky turns black when it passes over us. Isn't that amazing? We're going to be in the smack middle." Gerard, age 5, wasn't as keen to talk to me about this, but he did ask his mom if he would have to go to bed during the day because it will get dark. They all promised to send me photos and videos to document their first ever total eclipse, and I look forward to seeing it through their eyes. Wherever you are, I hope you too can experience this magnificent event. Jeff?
The second opinion piece today is by Rex Hupke, who is a USA Today columnist. His article entitled, "Here's a Man-to-Man Take of Women's Basketball Versus Sexism." "Great news, fellow men. I have thoroughly enjoyed the women's NCAA basketball tournament, and it has not caused me to die." Remarkable, right? And after watching Sunday's thriller NCAA championship game when the University of South Carolina's Gamecocks beat the University of Iowa's Hawkeyes, I can confidently say men everywhere now love women's basketball while continuing to exist. What a world. For years now, a sizable swath of the manosphere rejected women's basketball, discounting it for lack of dunks or lack of dudes or a violation of our beloved but secretive rules of the patriarchy and whatnot. The women's game seemed to have been invented so men could express deep thoughts like, "Why would anyone watch that when they can watch men play?" And, "I bet that women's college team couldn't beat the local high school boys team, and this hypothetical I came up with is in no way rooted in sexism." Whether it's college basketball or the WNBA, women's sports have long been fodder for important male thought leaders like the ones who do podcasts while wearing tank tops and looking like they'd pass out if they walked more than 20 feet. For ages, I assumed if I was ever caught watching a women's basketball game, I'd have my man card revoked and be sentenced to 400 hours of watching 1960s and 1970s sitcoms to re-educate myself on gender roles. Slowly, things have changed and become better for men. It started, I suppose, in 2015 when they released a Mad Max movie with a woman in the lead role. I liked Mad Max Fury Road and didn't feel like it had destroyed my childhood. That prepared me for the following year when an all-female remake of Ghostbusters came out. It was intimidating, of course, but I manned up, watched it, thought it was great, and somehow did not leave the theater emasculated and incapable of being a dude. My buds still call me Broseph. The age of Caitlin Clark, Angel Reese, and Paige Beckers. Fast forward to the emergence of NCAA superstar Caitlin Clark of Iowa, Louisiana State University's remarkable Angel Reese, and the University of Connecticut's fierce Paige Beckers. Those are all women, people, and they've turned this year's tournament into must-see TV. Part of me wants to think that the women's game has been good all along and that I was just not paying attention to it because their programs didn't get the same level of financial support or media attention. And part of me wonders if there's an ingrained misogyny in male culture that makes accepting women as equals somehow taboo because it means we men might no longer be totally in control of literally everything. But then I realized the problem was actually that LeBron James had not yet told me it was okay to watch women's basketball. The Los Angeles Lakers star has long been a fan, and he recently said, quote, "I don't think there's much difference between the men's and women's game when it comes to college basketball. I think the popularity comes with the icons they have in the women's game," end quote. Cool. Now we men have a man-endorsed permission structure that allows us to enjoy women's basketball without fear of being demanded. I'd like to congratulate my fellow men on this outstanding achievement. It takes a lot of courage for us to watch and appreciate a game that doesn't feature men doing the exact same thing. Way to go, guys. We did it. Carol?
Thank you, Jeff. And that ends opinions, and we'll go to the sports pages. Starting with sports on TV for today, Monday, April 8th. And these are all current central times that I'm going to give you. Men's college basketball at 8 p.m. can be seen on TBS NCAA Men's Final Four Championship game. For baseball, Major League Baseball at 4:10 p.m. on ESPN+, the Chicago White Sox will be at Cleveland. At 6:07 p.m. on MLBN, Seattle is at Toronto. At 6:20 p.m. on MLBN, New York Mets at Atlanta. At 8:38 p.m. on MLBN, Tampa Bay at Los Angeles. And the final one for Major League Baseball is at 8:40 p.m. on MLBN. It's Washington at San Francisco. And now here is Jeff.
Well, the big story in sports, of course, is the college women's basketball final. Iowa falls just short. Chad Lysakow's column in the Register is Clark ends her college career without a title, but gave Hawkeyes a chance. From the beginning of this incredible Iowa women's basketball season, there's always been an intense curiosity about how the career of the greatest player to ever wear a Hawkeye uniform would end. Would Caitlin Clark go to the WNBA or stay in school for one more year? Could she reach impossibly big expectations after taking Iowa to the NCAA national title game as a junior? How would her final moments, surely in front of one of the more raucous sellout crowds and a wildly entertained nation wearing an Iowa jersey, unfold? Well, we've reached the end, and we have our final answer. Clark ended her generational college career in the last moments of the last game of the 2024 women's basketball season. But for the second straight year, she and the Hawkeyes finished one spot shy of the ultimate prize. South Carolina's juggernaut roster and deep waves of talent overwhelmed the Hawkeyes, who even with one more parting gem of a performance from Clark, didn't have enough. The Gamecocks are your NCAA tournament champions after posting Sunday's 87-75 victory. Clark, like she did from day one in a Hawkeye uniform, gave everything she had and gave Iowa a chance to compete for even the biggest prizes, which was previously unthinkable. Iowa came out on the court Sunday and believed it could take down a roster loaded with future WNBA talent. Why? We have Caitlin Clark, junior Sydney Folter said. She's obviously the greatest player of all time. Iowa came out firing with a 10-0 haymaker out of the gate and led 20-9 in the first 4.5 minutes. But by the end of Sunday's game, the legs of every Hawkeye were drained, Clark's too. Obviously, we started really hot, but you know they're going to make a run, Clark said, smiling even in defeat in her final 12-minute press conference. As a Hawkeye, we were making some tough shots. They were really good. There's only so much you can do. We've got to give them a lot of credit. She was removed in an emotional scene with 20 seconds remaining, along with senior cohorts Kate Martin and Gabby Marshall. She hugged her coaches, and in a touching tribute, injured fifth-year senior Molly Davis got to take the floor one last time. Clark's final stat line, 30 points, 8 rebounds, and 5 assists against the nation's number one field goal percentage defense and a program that's now won 2 of the last 3 NCAA titles and 80 of its last 81 games. The only team to stop South Carolina in that span, Clark and the Hawkeyes, last season. Exhausted? Sure. Emotional? Of course. But Clark's prevailing thought after what could be seen as a crushing defeat was one of gratefulness. It was sad going into that locker room for the last time with those seniors who I love to death, Clark said. But there's so much to be thankful for outside of basketball. That's where I found my peace and calm. I reflect back on my career, and I know I gave it every single thing I had. There are so many people that basically believe there's no way Iowa would make the Final Four once. To do it twice? That's pretty incredible. And twice, she almost got Iowa to the pinnacle of the sport. It still seemed possible late in Sunday's game. Clark's feed to Martin for 2 sliced South Carolina's lead, once at 14 points, to 78-72, entering the final media timeout of the fourth quarter. A Folter's 3-point play cut it to 80-75 with 4:12 remaining. But Iowa simply ran out of gas and failed to score again. The Hawkeyes had the best player, but they were beaten by the best team. Yet with Clark, this was far from a one-sided affair. And if there was any doubt, Clark brought the fire from the beginning of Sunday's game, and so did the Hawkeyes, who roared out to a 10-0 lead. Martin splashed home a 3-pointer on Iowa's first possession, and Clark kept it rolling with an audacious surge of 18 first-quarter points. Amazingly, she was still 5 shy of the 23 she poured in against Michigan on February 15th, but it was quite the Clark show in front of a pro-Hawkeye Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse crowd. The Hawkeyes led by as many as 11 in the opening 10 minutes, and Clark's third 3-pointer pushed Iowa's first quarter lead to 27-20. Behind its superstar, Iowa announced that it was going to come out punching in this title bout. That narrative quickly changed in the second quarter, which saw the Gamecocks score 29 points and dominate the offensive glass while holding Clark to a single 3-pointer. Iowa trailed 49-46 at the break, and South Carolina probably felt okay that it had held Clark to only 21 points after that searing start. So South Carolina's advantage quickly ballooned to 9 points in the third quarter. The tired legs mounted for Iowa with a 1-for-9 quarter from 3-point range, and it was 68-59 entering the fourth. Having Clark wasn't enough for the Hawkeyes to win it, but they sure delivered an unbelievable ride for Hawkeye fans behind their superstar, the West Des Moines native choosing to inject her home state team with life rather than play for a power school elsewhere. One of the best decisions I ever made in my life, Clark said. There's not a regret in my mind of how things went. I'll be able to sleep at night, even though I never won a national championship. Everything I've done, there's so much to be proud of. I don't sit and sulk about the things that never happened. Throughout Clark's final season, there have been continued parallels of Michael Jordan's last dance with the Chicago Bulls in 1998. Not everything is similar, but much of it is. For months, there have been traveling roadshows and unprecedented attention on one player and this team. And all along, fans have known that one way or another, this would be the end of the line for an all-time great. Time for Dear Abby. Here's Carol.
Thanks, Jeff. Dear Abby, this is the third time I have received a gift of a political book from my brother-in-law. We are poles apart politically. It came with a message to, quote, please read the book, and then in capitals, this time, unquote. He is expecting a book report and discussion of the book when he next visits. He started doing this several years ago after my sister died. She used to keep him politically in check. I have tried tactfully responding that I do not enjoy reading political books, that I do not approve of name-calling, that those who disagree with us are not stupid, and we just need to accept our differing viewpoints. There is no way to have a rational political discussion with him. I'm trying to preserve family unity, which is very important to me. My brother wants to threaten him to stop harassing me. My son and his wife suggested sending him things that reflect my political philosophy. What do you think I should do? I waver between anger and laughter. By the way, I sent him a box of chocolate chip cookies, which he loves, for the holidays. Signed, Harassed in Ohio. And Abby says, Dear Harassed, your brother-in-law is not going to change. Unless you are willing to tolerate his political browbeating into eternity, return the book and postpone his next visit indefinitely. Continue sending him his chocolate chip cookies only if he agrees to quit sending you political literature. Family unity may be important to you, but your late sister's husband has distanced himself, and that is no one's fault but his own. And our second letter to Abby. Dear Abby, I've been going out with a man who is 9 years younger than I am. He's a musician who plays bass guitar in several bands. I am retired. I love going out dancing with him and being social with other friends. I met him at a social club a year and a half ago. He works during the week at a fast food place. Some weekends he goes away on gigs with the band. He has been married 4 times. My problem is, he never has any money. He is always struggling to pay his bills. I have invested in this relationship with concert tickets, hotels, etc. He pays only occasionally. I think he's cheap. I have taken breaks from him a couple of times because I know he's not going to change, and I need to move on. Please advise. Signed, Always Hoping for More. And Abby says, Dear Always Hoping, the question you must answer for yourself is how much entertainment tax you are willing to pay for the pleasure of this wandering minstrel's company. You foot the bills for his and your entertainment because it is part of your unwritten contract, and he expects it. This 4 times married man has chosen a career he loves, but that notoriously does not pay well. You know who he is. Have you spoken to him about your feelings on this? If you haven't, do it now. And if the arrangement is no longer suits you, move on. Jeff?
That brings us to the end of the Des Moines Register for today, the 8th day of April, 2024. I'm Jeff Cassett. My partner at the microphone has been Carol Lockhart. Earlier, you heard from Nicole Tam and Twyla Glenn. You can listen to IRIS programs on any computer or smart device at any time at iowaradioreading.org. Support for today's readings comes from the Des Moines Register, Iowa Public Radio, Iowa PBS, and bensoundmusic.com. Thank you for listening to IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.